Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'd like to plug the Chase Thomas podcast. Listen to Chase Thomas. You'll be a smarter sports fan and obviously a much better human being.
Matt Chernoff from 680 The Fan's Chuck and Chernoff show here. And I want to say thanks for listening to today's episode of the Chase Thomas podcast. You can find it on Apple, Spotify, and all your favorite podcast apps. Chase Thomas went to Parkview in North Georgia. He's a local Atlanta kid, and he won't let the Luka versus Trey thing go. He interned with us back in the day, and you'll always remember him. Anyway, definitely go check out ChaseThomasPodcast.com, where you can find all of Chase's previous episodes, all of his articles, and do him a solid. Leave him a rating and review if you're an Apple Podcast listener. Reminder to listen to our show, Chuck and Chernoff, Monday through Friday, 3 to 7 on 680 The Fan, and subscribe to my podcast as well. Welcome to Matlanta, wherever you get your podcasts.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Chase Thomas podcast, where I'm still the aforementioned Chase Thomas, coming to you live from Knoxville, Tennessee, up there in New York City.
New York City.
Fangraph's own John Taylor.
There we go.
Yeah, there you go, buddy. No backdrop tonight for the youtube.com/Chase Thomas podcast, folks. No skyline of New York City here tonight.
No, just a lovely pink floral arrangement behind me. Got my softer side out. I know people like that.
You should be like, we should just play up to a different room. It's a different room in John's apartment.
I know that's what the viewers have been clamoring for. You know, they come up to me on the streets and they tell me all the time, you know, we love the podcast. It's so great, but can we please see some more backgrounds, some more backdrops? And I'd say we're looking at it very strongly and we're going to do something about it.
There you go. John, since my running days are behind me, probably like after hitting the 32-year-old wall here in a couple months, when I broke my foot running the week of my wedding last year, it's been a pain with PT and getting back to 100% with my foot. And I can't run every day anymore. Like, those days are gone of me being a daily runner. My body's breaking down, John. So I've been like mulling, switching it up and being like, all right, when I'm good to go, what am I going to do instead? And I've taken up swimming, John Taylor, and I'm doing the breaststroke, I'm doing the butterfly, I'm doing a solid workout in the pool that I started today. And let me tell you, John, there is nothing that looks goofier than another grown-up wearing goggles and a swimmer's cap in the pool with you.
Yeah, that's a really hard look to pull off, not to lie. I think you should try it. Definitely get one of those swim caps that has like the fake flowers on the edges too. Get yourself some water wings. I think you would look great doing that.
I would rather just be a shark, like put a little shark hat on and just that's something I would do, but I can't do it. Like, I looked at him, it was like George Costanza. I love that you're comfortable in that look. I am not personally comfortable in it, so I'll take the chlorine in the eyes over that to this point. We'll see if I keep that going from here on out, but right now, John, the biggest issue is just whether or not to be that guy. And I'm not Michael Phelps. I'm over here just get my workout in. I'm not that serious. I just think it looks silly to be like that much ducked out in the equipment when that's not what I'm trying to do. So I don't know. It's something I had not considered, but I'm not doing it as of right now.
Okay. All right. Well, look, there's still plenty of time for you to embrace your inner aquatics What's the thing that the seniors do at the pool? They work out in the pool and they do the very light aerobics.
Yeah, I think it's just water aerobics, right?
Is it just water? Yeah, well, there's plenty of time for you to embrace that still.
That's what I'm doing.
Transition to old age.
I mean, I'm married. I'm done. Like, I am.
You're done. You're out.
Like, I am done, man. But I'm also just done getting hurt. Like, I am over hurt at my age where it takes so long now to heal and get back. And I just don't want to be sidelined like that anymore. I've got to do my daily exercises that just do not put me in jeopardy of just putting me on the shelf for 4 months. Like, I can't. I'm not about it. Like, we think about it with athletes where, oh, wow, what LeBron has to do to keep his body in perfect shape is like when you're in a chamber and all this stuff. I'm just too old.
The hyperbaric chamber.
Yeah.
Ice baths.
I don't have any of that, man.
Well, it's just funny too, because like I read something on Defector today about LeBron James. He scored 40 plus against the Clippers, which means he's now scored 40 plus against every team in the league at least once.
Yeah.
But the highlights, he just looked so miserable the entire time. Where it's like this is where this has ended up. All those incredible treatments and the hyperbaric chambers and the protein drinks and everything, and yet here you are sitting on the bench watching Russell Westbrook and, you know, someone else get into an argument while you're losing by 30 points to the little brother franchise that also operates in this arena, and just looking the whole time like just the perpetual Joe Bluth, I've made a huge mistake face. Yeah.
Well, hey, that's no point.
There's your lesson, people. There's no point.
There you go. It's a look that I think we'll see on Mike Trout's face for the rest of his prime in years. I suspect. Yeah.
Well, as you've said, and as has been kind of been made up, like, and I agree to a certain degree, like, he kind of made this particular bet for himself. So, and
LeBron made the bet that he's made in Los Angeles. You get a lot of picks. You won your title, and this is just kind of what happens after the fact.
It's funny that Trout and LeBron both kind of end up in that same place of, look, like, yeah, this team may be crap, but also we get to live in Los Angeles. So,
right. Which I get. But who wants to live in Kansas City when you can live in Boston, Massachusetts? That's what our guy Mondesi is thinking as the new backup shortstop in Beantown. John, how great is it for Alberto Mondesi to become a Boston Red Sox? Are you elated? How are you celebrating?
Let me say that parade's going up and down Boylston right now. The party's been in full swing for several days. I'm not even there. I'm 800 miles away, or however far away New York is from Boston, 400, I guess. And I can hear the celebration coming from there. They're singing on the roofs in Dorchester. They're singing in the streets of Stoughton. They're just going wild in Revere, and I'm out of Boston town names. But no, I mean, it is of a piece of this Red Sox offseason that they have a solution where you look at it and you go, okay, I guess. Because like Mondesi and Adalberto Mondesi there are a few qualities that make him kind of ideal for what the Red Sox want to do here. For first, he's actually a good defensive shortstop. And while Kike Hernandez, I know there, you know, he's played shortstop before, you know, he's played an acceptable shortstop before. I think he could probably do it, maybe. That's the fact that there is that maybe ... several question marks makes me feel better about the fact that there is someone who has actually recently played shortstop.
Yeah.
Who is, by all metrics, is good at it, who is there. And I think it's something similar, although in a different direction, as to what the Dodgers have with Gavin Lux and Miguel Rojas, where, you know, with Lux, you know, they clearly want him to be the guy. But I imagine there is presumably some internal debate as to whether or not he can be the guy. So in case he can't be the guy, here's a veteran dude with a good glove who knows his role, who doesn't cost much, you know, who can do the job for us if we need a guy to step in for Lux. Or even if he can be the guy, at least a guy we can say, like, oh, he's just an available defensive replacement. So we can, you know, get Lux off of short, and maybe we can put Lux at second to get Max Muncy or you know, Chris Taylor. It opens up some dimensions for the Dodgers defensively, and I think Mondesi does the same thing here, although on a somewhat more limited basis. If it really does look like Kike Hernandez cannot stick at shortstop regularly, then they can just stick Mondesi there, put him at the bottom of the lineup, and at least live with the fact that he's fast and he has a good glove. If Christian Arroyo is really struggling at second base, maybe Mondesi can become an option there. And in turn, if Mondesi can be a guy to give Hernandez a break from having to play shortstop regularly, that lets him go back to center field, which is which he plays very well defensively, so that the Red Sox don't have to play Adam Duvall there on a full-time basis, which is kind of crazy. So what I don't like to spend what, and I, for what it's worth, I think the trade itself is fine. The Red Sox gave up virtually not very much. A 30-year-old lefty reliever named Josh Taylor, who didn't pitch at all last year because of back problems. I don't really understand this trade from Kansas City side, aside from they're just punting on Mondesi, but I kind of don't understand how they couldn't do better than a 30-year-old left-handed reliever who did not pitch last year. That seems like they were selling.
Well, they also did this thing themselves because they just completely botched the Mondesi call up. Like, that's the whole thing. It's like his career is just sad because he got botched when he came up.
This is what I don't like about Mondesi in particular, is that he has never been a good hitter, and it's pretty obvious at this point it's not going to happen, barring a huge fundamental change in his approach to the plate, because he is a big time free swinger. He does not draw walks. He is not a patient hitter. He does not hit for particularly any real power. He is a ground and pound speed guy. And that's fine for what he is, but it also really limits his ceiling in terms of, I think in an ideal world, the Red Sox would have gotten someone who not only can function as that potential backup for Hernandez, but also maybe, you know, take the job outright. Mm-hmm. And I think that possibility could exist with Mondesi. I mean, he's still relatively young. This is his final year under contract. He'll be a free agent next season. So there's going to be obviously a lot of incentive for him to do well and play well and also play regularly so he can show other teams, hey, I'm a regular starting shortstop. Sign me to a deal. And again, the competition is really just Kike Hernandez, and he is needed other places too. You know, I think what I like most about this is that it does open up some defensive flexibility, and it gives the Red Sox both a very good defensive middle infielder to plug in for two guys who are not as good as he is in the late innings, and also a really good pinch running threat off the bench. Mondesi is a very fast base runner. Not the best in terms of success rate, but at the very least a guy you can put on first to swipe a base, or on second if you need a single, or if you just
might be better with the new rule changes though this year.
And that could be a case too with the new rule changes that should make stealing bases a little bit easier. On top of the fact that, again, having Mondesi there means you can use Kike Hernandez in the outfield, where he's a better defender than Adam Duvall and Alex Verdugo, although I don't want Kike playing right field or what have you. I just think there's not that much visible upside in this, because at this point we know pretty well what Mondesi is. And he's basically Nathy Perez for all intents and purposes. So maybe that's probably a little harsh on Mondesi. But at the same time, I think it's of a piece with this Red Sox offseason where it's not a bad move, but it's a move where you're like, why can't we do better than this? And it's a move that reminds me a fair amount of what teams like, or what, for example, the Marlins are going to do now that they've swapped Pablo Lopez for Luis Arraez, put Arraez at second base and move Jazz Chisel to center. Because instead of, and what I find frustrating about that with regards to the Red Sox and the Marlins is there were probably better options than that that simply require just spending more money. That this is the kind of roster workaround you have to do when you have a very hard imposed budget, and when you don't want to get, where you just don't want to really spend anymore. And I think you're seeing that to a certain degree, like Boston's decision-making is really being impacted by that. Like the fact that Matt Barnes was the guy who got DFA'd for Duvall to join the 40-man roster, despite the fact he has $7-some million owed him this year. I think it's pretty clear that Boston is trying to focus on, let's build a roster that has flexibility, both in terms of positional flexibility and in terms of roster flexibility, such as, you know, Barnes got the boot because guys like Wyatt Mills and Caleb Ort, though they're worse pitchers almost certainly, they have options left. They can be moved down if something needs to happen. Barnes, obviously the only route available to him was a DFA. So, you know, it's almost like you might as well peel the Band-Aid off now and get it over with. But again, this is all in service of a roster that just doesn't feel particularly deep anyway, and that doesn't feel complete. And it feels more like a patchwork kind of job where it's like, okay, well, we lost our starting shortstop, but that's okay because our second baseman can now be the shortstop. Okay, our new shortstop blew out his elbow, so now we're going to take our center fielder and put him at shortstop. But that's not going to work all the time, so we're going to trade for another shortstop. It just becomes this really complicated game of like trying to patch a leak by just, you know, in those cartoons where like a dam would start leaking and a character would start like plugging holes with their fingers. Every time one leak gets plugged, another one just starts popping up because the roster just isn't really built. This is just not a particularly efficiently maximized, or this is not a maximally efficient roster. You know, this is a roster that has a lot of moving parts that, on the one hand, that can work. You know, the Giants have shown that it worked in 2021. The Rays have shown pretty regularly that it works. But you also need that kind of star. You need those consistent, like locked in star players. And I think that's where Boston is really short, where if Xander Bogaerts were still here, well, I don't know that they would have traded for Mondesi anyway. But I would obviously feel a lot better about Raul Jr. at one point, but about Adalberto being there as a backup.
Wait, Raul Jr. at one point? What do you mean?
He went by Raul Jr. at one point and then changed it to Adalberto.
Did he really?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
Like at the very beginning of his career, he was Raul Mondesi Jr.
Huh. Yeah.
Either way, it's fine for what Boston's roster is, and it makes sense for what their roster is, but I think the problem is the roster itself is just fundamentally flawed. And so something like, well, we'll get Adalberto Mondesi, even though he can't really hit, and just hope that it'll work out, that ends up just being kind of your best case like solution. Because again, everything leading up to that point was already kind of messed up. So you're just kind of trying to paper over the previous mistakes or whatever.
Yeah. You're kind of in the Rays zone now, John, where it's just these moves, you're going to have guys who can play every position and you're going to patch all this together and you're going to have.
I've accepted that sad fate that, you know, this is just how the Red Sox want to be run. And I think that became abundantly clear with their Fan Fest stuff, where Chaim Bloom was speaking and got booed loudly. Ownership, John Henry speaking publicly about the team for the first time, it feels like years, coming out and saying nonsense, essentially getting booed for it. I think that's notable too, that Red Sox fans are really not happy right now, that they've watched this offseason and gone, this makes no sense. We've now had two of our favorite franchise players of the last forever leave. You know, it's good that Devers is staying, obviously, but it's really clear too that he is like all that the Red Sox are really like focusing on right now. This is just the reality that when you hear Chaim Bloom talk about the fact that, oh, the farm system is much better now, or when you hear John Henry say falsely that, you know, we need fans to come to the game and buy tickets to support a high revenue, to support a high payroll, it becomes really clear that they are explicitly about, look, this isn't good. We're not going to be the team you want us to be unless we have more money or unless this farm system stuff really works. And it's funny that what Bloom is talking about farm system wise doesn't really line up with reality either. The Red Sox under Bloom, especially at least the drafts that they've done, have not really unearthed much of anything aside from Marcelo Mayer, a potential number one pick who kind of fell into their laps at number three. Like a lot of the guys, especially internationally, who are now making really big strides, like Sedan Rafaela or Brian Bayo, those were Dombrowski era signings that have only just now started to make their way up because these kids were signed at like 16 or 17 years old. So yeah, it has been very clear since the Mookie Betts trade and really since Bloom was hired that the philosophy of the day in Boston is forced austerity. And this is the end result of forced austerity, as a team where you look at the roster and you go, this doesn't really make any sense. I mean, similarly, signing Adam Duvall, sure, fine. He's a good hitter. He crushes left-handed pitching. He has a lot of power. I think it's a good option. It's good for what Boston needs, but he shouldn't be a regular, especially not in center field. That doesn't make sense. That's the kind of roster construction that happens when your plan for building a roster doesn't let you do stuff like, okay, we just have to pay a lot to keep the elite option. Like we just have to pay a lot of money if we want Xander Bogaerts to be here still. There's no way around that one. And to me, that is just the most frustrating thing, that there are obvious avenues for improvement. There are obvious ways for this team to be better, but that this ownership group has decided has just very clearly decided there is only a certain level we're going to spend, and it's not going to be to the level that ensures that we can have a roster that doesn't feel like it was assembled blindfolded. Because that's really ultimately what this feels like, is a roster where you're just like, I don't get why half of this is the case.
And the worst possible scenario here, I think, if you're like now the Red Sox fans, I wonder if they're kind of in a pickle, John. And last thing on the Red Sox here, but like I saw today that like MLB Network was talking about, like, I think they had the second best, they were picked the second most likely worst to first teams of anyone in Major League Baseball. And like, if you're a Red Sox fan, like, you want to see your team win more games than lose more games. Like, that's just part, like, that's, unless you're like the Pirates or whatever, it's just like, you're just, it is what it is. But like, the Red Sox should go into every year like, hey, we should be contending for a title. We are in one of those markets and we are one of those franchises that really should have just kind of crazy expectations. And now you're like, I don't want the John Henry and this staff and this front office to win here, where if they do go worst to first because injuries derail a lot of the top of the AL East and they sneak in there with what they've assembled and after everything that's happened this offseason. I just feel like Red Sox fans will be completely conflicted. And I'm curious if you will feel the same, like if they actually did pull it off and just everyone's right and everyone is healthy and Kike is awesome and you just go up and down the list and everyone bounces back and the pitching's great, and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe this team's going to win like 90 games, and now they're going to keep this thing going like this for years at a time, because it's a proof of concept of, see what happens when you become the Rays 2.0? This is what you could do right here.
But like, that's, to me, and if the Red Sox have a great season, great, fine, whatever. Like, ultimately, I want the Red Sox to be good more than I want them, much more than I want them to be bad. A bad Red Sox team is of no interest to me, because a bad Red Sox team is a Red Sox team I'm not going to be watching anyway. Like, and I think that's the case for a lot of Boston fans too, that, you know, a bad Red Sox team is not something that they're going to set aside 3 hours a night for 6 straight months. That's just not real. That's not realistic in a world where there are a billion other things to do. For me, the issue is more that, and I think you said it as you were asking it, so many things have to go right for this Red Sox team to be good, not just on the roster itself in terms of like 90th percentile outcomes. Like you say, everyone stays healthy. You know, the guys who struggled last year come back to a good level of performance. They get unexpected performance from, you know, their minor leaguers, their waiver claims, their veteran free agents, whatever it happens to be. But also they need 20th percentile performance from like the rest of the AL East. They need the Yankees to have a lot of injuries. They need the Blue Jays to have injuries. They need the That's not a viable contention strategy. That's not a viable strategy at all. If your strategy relies on everything goes right for me, everything goes wrong for everyone else, that's not going to get, that is how you end up going worst to first and worst to first. That's just how you end up on this weird ping pong path that the Bloom Red Sox have been on, where you just don't know what you're going to get year to year because there is so much variability on the roster. You don't have those star players right now. You can just say every year, I feel good about this guy being a 5-win player or whatever it is, or I feel good that this guy is going to give me 180 innings this year, you know, regardless of who it is. To me, so to me, it's like, I don't really care about the result so much as I care about the process for how this team is doing it. And to me, the process suggests that the result is going to be inconsistent, and that I didn't like, and that if all the good things happen, that it is not by design to a certain degree. It is by design, but it also is going to have to take advantage of a lot of luck. And every baseball season relies on luck to a certain degree. I mean, you know, the Phillies look like, or you look at last year's Phillies, you look at the 2021 Red Sox, you've got the 2013 Red Sox, you know, those were unexpected contend, like championship contending teams. For me, it's what I want to see from this Red Sox team is a commitment to consistently being a team that looks like it can win 90 plus games. This team looks like it could win 90, or it looks like it could win 75. Any number between those two would not surprise me this season. Honestly, I'd probably be more surprised by anything over 85 versus under 85. Because ultimately to me, this, and this is the other problem, they have built in a lower ceiling for themselves because of all this variability that makes me think that it would take a lot going right for them to be a contending team. And more likely than not, that's not going to happen because things go wrong. Like, that is baseball. Things go wrong. And so what is frustrating for me is just knowing that even if they do well this season, it's probably going to be because of a lot of variables that they cannot control and that you cannot realistically expect will repeat themselves going forward. You know what I mean? Like, if James Paxton has a great season and that's why the Red Sox contend, that's something you can bank on again going forward.
Yeah.
Kike Hernandez having a great season, that's not something you can bank on going forward. Like,
but Heim Bloom could be like, yeah, we know, and we'll just keep mixing and matching, and we'll get those just high, like, not even high upside, but just like the guys where if everything goes right, then look, we're geniuses, and everything goes wrong, you're like, well, see, you put too much faith in James Paxton. He's like, guess what? We're going to bounce back and do it with a different guy each and every year.
And that ultimately is just building excuses for why you don't spend that much, just to be able to say, look, like, because ultimately, I think, and I think that is the case, like, were they to have a great season with this particular roster, I think the ultimate feeling would be that is, in the end of the day, bad long-term. This particular contention plan, as reliant as it is on just swapping parts constantly and never paying more than a very hard set determined mark, like, value for a player, just does not strike me as a way to build a consistently winning team unless your player development group is outstanding. And the Red Sox player development group is very much not that. They have very few successes to point to in the last 3 years in terms of players from either in or outside the organization that they have made better at the major league level. You know, it's one thing when the Dodgers have an offseason like this where it just seems like they're collecting spare parts. And you're like, well, I don't really like this process for the Dodgers. But they're also a really good player development team with a very, very strong farm system. And everyone there clearly knows what they're doing. So you know, the outcomes can be wide, but at the same time, you feel pretty good that the Dodgers will contend. And also that this is probably not how it's going to be going forward with them necessarily. With the Red Sox, you don't really get that sense because you're like, where are the victories supposed to come from in a sense?
Mm.
You know, I mean, illustrative thing, like Jeffrey Springs just signed a 4-year contract extension with the Rays. The Red Sox dumped him a year ago for a catching prospect who looked good at the time but didn't take off. And then Springs, as unsurprisingly with the Rays, found a different gear thanks to an arsenal change and probably some mechanical stuff, and is now a very good back end of the rotation starting pitcher.
Mm.
That's not the, that is, that has been emblematic of Chaim Bloom's time in Boston, is not getting the most you can out of players, not maximizing what they can do for you, and ultimately just the valuations for everyone just feel off in a particular way where it doesn't seem like they have a really good read as to the value of certain players or who has, you know, even just like, for as much as I don't think like losing Matt Barnes is any big deal, like he's lost velocity and he's clearly not the same pitcher he was 4 years ago when during Boston's very long, very good 2018 playoff run, or during their World Series run rather, why is Ryan Brazier still on this roster?
Mm.
There's no good reason why Ryan Brazier should be on a major league roster in 2023. He's been one of the worst relievers in baseball the last 2 years running. Mm. What is that front office seeing that makes them continue to stick with a guy like that? What is that front office seeing where they think Kike Hernandez can be a full-time shortstop? I don't really think anyone else in baseball believes that. There are so many things that Boston seems to believe that no one else in the league really seems to be in alignment with them on. And like, on the one hand, that, now I'm not saying that every team has to think the same way, but on the other hand, it's kind of unusual to see what, I guess the best way of putting it, anytime you see the Red Sox do stuff, I feel like the immediate reaction is, what are they doing that for? Where after you think about it, you're like, well, it makes sense. It's like, but what are they doing that for? Why don't they just go get a better regular shortstop? This is not a solution. This is a Band-Aid in a sense. And it just feels like, it feels like permanent solutions are not being offered unless permanent solutions happen to come from within the farm system and make the major league minimum for the first 3 years. And I think that's the most frustrating part of it. Is like you said, this is not a market that needs to be small. You know, this is not Pittsburgh, although you can argue to Pittsburgh as no market needs to be small, but this is not a small market team. This is one of the largest markets in baseball, one of the most successful franchises in baseball, with an owner who can afford both this team and one of the best Premier League teams in England. Like, why are the Penguins? Why are they operating like a franchise? Why are they having a Pirates offseason? That just makes no sense to me. And it's one of the things where you can totally understand how that ownership group in front office get booed when they show up in front of the fans, because I think the fans realize it too. Why are we having a Pirates offseason? Why is this how this team operates now? You know, under Dombrowski, it was big free agents, big trades. Now it's this? And it ultimately just feels like it wasn't necessary. Like, the only reason this is happening is because John Henry looked at his bank account and went, oh, no, it's getting a little too low. We gotta pump those numbers up. So I guess to make that all short, I will be conflicted if this particular Red Sox team is good, because at the end of the day, I want Red Sox teams to be good, but I don't think this process in which this team has been, but the process by which this team has been built, I don't think it's a sustainable one. I don't think it's one that really offers a lot of flexibility down the road. And I think it's rewarding the wrong impulses within that ownership group at front office. So, like you said, to say, see, we can win like the Rays. You shouldn't have to win like the Rays. The Rays win like the Rays because their ownership group has given them no other choice. They have had to do this. That shouldn't be the case in a city like Boston.
I would agree. Well, there's your Red Sox minute, folks. The state of the Red Sox. We have to do this on this podcast because no one else is going to do this outside of it. We have to put the pressure on. That's what this podcast is for. Putting the pressure on the Red Sox ownership group and front office. Do better things, because it would make John and myself happy. Speaking of ownership groups that do not make fan bases happy, Artie Moreno is not selling the Angels, John Taylor. And you texted me and you were like, I laughed out loud when I saw this news. John, what do you make of Artie Moreno not selling the Angels after all?
Poor Angels fans.
Mm.
Poor Angels fans. Like, I get it. Like, no, I don't get it. Well, I get it because Artie Moreno is a billionaire, and billionaires do not operate by any sense of logic that any of us mere non-billionaires can understand. Like, access to that much money, power, and wealth ultimately is incredibly bad for your brain, and I think Moreno is a really good example of that. because he had, if the reporting can be believed, and I don't see why not, he had an offer of at least $2.5 billion on the table from the Angel, for the Angels.
And he paid it for $183 million.
Yes, like 20 years ago. It's very funny. He bought that team right after they won a World Series, and they haven't done jack shit since.
Yeah. But it's also weird that you see that he bought it from the Walt Disney Company. Like, that's just such a weird thing that they own this team.
The Mouse House owned the Angels for a little bit there. Baseball ownership. But so, yeah, that's kind of the weird thing to me about Moreno is he made his money back. He made his investment back 10 times over by this point without even selling the team. You know, and to say nothing of the fact that his ownership has been a disaster through and through. The Angels haven't made the playoffs in 9 years. They've completely wasted the prime of the second coming of Mickey Mantle. They have wasted the first years of the career of basically supercharged Babe Ruth, whom they are going to have to trade at some point in the next 12 to 16 months because he quite simply does not want to be there, and understandably so. And I think this would make sense if Moreno secretly had a deal with Ohtani to re-sign, and that's why he's not giving up the team. But that would also just make me sad because I don't want Shohei Ohtani stuck in Anaheim forever. It's sad enough that Mike Trout is there. But with regards to Moreno specifically, mind-boggling he would turn down that money. But I guess part of being a billionaire is if you already have billions of dollars, what do you need more billions of dollars for? There's a certain cachet, obviously, that comes with owning a baseball team that I don't think he wants to give up, even though he's very clearly shown that he's not capable of running a team efficiently. The other weird thing about it, too, is the reporting that his children – have no interest in taking over the team when he dies. And we've already seen how poorly that started to play out in places like Baltimore, where the Angelo siblings have been feuding constantly since their father stepped away as the primary owner of that team. I'm not sure if Peter Angelos is still alive or not, but I know he's been very sick for a long time, so that's part of it. We've seen that obviously to a certain degree in other sports where, you know, families seem to have no interest, like the Walton family with the Broncos, who's the family that owned the Saints and got into a whole mess of ownership stuff when the patriarch of that family died?
Yeah, and it's now the wife, Benson, Judy Benson.
Family.
Yeah,
like I know it's a neat idea that like a baseball team can be like something passed down through the family, but like it doesn't work that way. There's no guarantee that the Moreno family has any interest in this beyond
watch
once
Succession,
he dies.
Folks.
Yeah, and there's also no guarantee that the Moreno kids are going to be any better than this. In fact, they're probably going to be worse. There's no reason to expect that.
Probably going to be hard to be worse than what Moreno's done in the last decade.
This is not like the Rooney family owning the Steelers.
Yeah.
You know, where there's always, I think, been this belief and expectation that the first and foremost thing this family cares about is the Pittsburgh Steelers. And, you know, making sure that Steelers fans get a winner day in and like year in and year out. That does not seem to be the case with Artie Moreno. He does not seem to care whether or not the Angels win, given the extensive amount of meddling he does and given how budget conscious the Angels have been in a lot of different ways, aside from giving Mike Trout all the money in the world.
I was gonna say, they're not even really budget conscious, though. Like Rendon, Ohtani, they've been a stars and scrubs team.
I think it's penny wise and pound foolish in Anaheim. Or you can even say penny foolish and pound wise, I guess. Because, giving Mike Trout a lot of money is a really smart investment. You know, giving Anthony Rendon, even though that deal has not particularly worked out, he was at the time, one of the best third basemen in baseball, a great defender. You know, chronic injuries have hampered that, obviously, but that at least is something where you can look at it and go, okay, well, that makes sense. If you're going to give a lot of money to somebody, give it to that guy. It's more the moves like Zach Cozart is always the one I come back to where it's like they gave Zach Cozart like a 3-year, $36 million deal. And it's like, why did you do that? Like your organization should have a Zach Cozart in it somewhere in the minor league, or you should be able to find one on the waiver wire. Like the stuff that Mike Trout does cannot be replicated by all but a handful of Major League Baseball players. The stuff that Zach Cozart did, probably half the league could have done that. Why are you paying what you're like? There just doesn't, and I think that's part of the thing with the Angels. There just doesn't seem to be a visible plan or intelligence as to how things are going. It just seems to be dictated by the whims of a meddling idiot owner. And so that ultimately is why I just feel so bad for Angels fans, especially for them to have it yanked away like this, to be told for so many months, I'm selling the team, to know there's an offer out there. Maybe they'd be worse than Moreno, but maybe it might be a Steve Cohen type deal. Someone who wants to come in and really put his stamp on a team that doesn't really have an image and that in a lot of ways is really behind the league in certain ways. Sam Blum, the Angels beat writer for The Athletic, does a really good job kind of chronicling all the various ways in which the Angels have just come up really short against the rest of the league, to say nothing of the team in their own, you know, obviously in their, let's say the Angels are more in the Dodgers' backyard, but having to compete with the Dodgers for eyes and attention in Los Angeles, as well as the, you know, the Lakers, the Clippers, the football teams, the hockey teams, like, that's really hard, especially when the Angels aren't even in Los Angeles. But it, you just don't get the sense that Moreno has any interest in making that effort to have this team be anything more than a shiny bauble he owns that he likes to take out of its case and look at sometimes. That is the only real vibe you get from Artie Moreno as Angels owner. And
I think some guys just like being in the club more. Like, where you read their statement where Artie couldn't, he said, like, Rob Manfred's statement said, quote, despite strong buyer interest in the Angels, Artie Moreno's love of the game is most important to him. I am very pleased that the Moreno family has decided to continue on the team. I just get the sense that it was not, the money was not right for somebody to come in. It's just that dude thought about it and was like, this is kind of fun, just being in the club, just saying I own the Angels. Like, I can make the money. I'm already a billionaire. Who really, what's another couple billion? I'm going to keep owning the Angels. That's what I'm going to do. I like being in this this club.
And that is the cachet, where it's like you're in a very expensive club as a Major League Baseball owner. And giving that up means giving up that access. It means giving up being Artie Moreno, owner of the Los Angeles Angels.
Yeah.
It just sucks because it's very clear that what would be best for that franchise and its fan base is for someone else to be in charge at this point. Because Artie Moreno has pretty clearly demonstrated over the course of his ownership that he doesn't know what he's doing, that he is a negative influence as an owner, that he meddles too much, that he doesn't really understand the game or how it operates at this point in time. You know, and it's, I do find it very funny that Rob Manfred is like, I'm so happy Artie Moreno's sticking around. It's like, are you? The two marquee names in baseball, or two of the most marquee names in baseball, are stuck on a team that is always losing, no one watches, and this buffoon who owns a team is the primary reason why these two jewels of the sport exist in this wasteland of a franchise. If I were Manfred, I'd be furious that Moreno doesn't want to leave, because I want new blood.
Yeah. You know,
I want someone who actually is going to make that team good. And
it's in a huge market. This is not like the Royals or Indians or Guardians, whatever. It's like, no, you're in freaking LA.
If Royals ownership changes hands, so be it. Like, they're still going to be the Royals. The Angels, there's a real opportunity to do something there and to make them a viable powerhouse franchise in baseball. All it takes is the right amount of investment and investment in the right people. And Artie Moreno just clearly isn't going to do that. You know, I just find it frustrating that the commissioner of baseball is happy that a bad owner is choosing to remain a bad owner. But at the end of the day, I mean, to a certain degree, Artie Moreno signs Rob Manfred's checks. So I can kind of understand why he's like, I'm so happy Artie's back. Especially because I think, too, Manfred ultimately doesn't care what the owners do, so long as they are not pulling a Donald Sterling and visibly, audibly, publicly becoming a pariah in the process, you know? Also, I would encourage Angels fans, just follow Artie Moreno around with a tape recorder. Just see what he says. You know what? You might get lucky. You might luck yourself into a Donald Sterling situation. You never know.
You could do that with really any owner, and you might get it for any sport.
I'm shocked that Mets fans didn't do that with... I mean, granted, the Wilpons weren't exactly out and about on the town, but like, I kind of had figured that at some point some Mets fan was just going to like try to like create some situation where one of them said a racial slur like on the record. And just like snowball it from, like, I kind of figured the Donald Sterling thing would give every angry fan base a playbook to try to get rid of their own owner, to be like, let's see if we can entrap him by saying something racist. But I guess the missing factor there is that Donald Sterling isn't just racist. He's also very stupid. So that has to, you know, those things have to work together, or stupid and shameless. That's kind of the other thing.
And I always think about that Barbara Walters interview with that, with his friend. What did she call herself? And then Barbara's like, you're what? His what? That's what she said. It was an iconic, his what?
R.I.P. Barbara.
She's great.
Great studio in the sky.
Yeah. John Taylor.
Yes.
Scott Rolen made the Hall of Fame this week.
Yes, he did.
Was it deserved? Does it feel right saying Scott Rolen, Hall of Famer?
I think so. I mean, you're talking about one of the best defensive third basemen pretty much ever. And not just that, but also a guy who was an above average hitter for the great majority of his career, you know, and it was in terms of overall, to me, it's like for this kind of thing, like I just tend to defer to Jay Jaffe's Jaws rankings just because it's just a really neat, quick, and easy way to sum up where a guy stands compared to his compatriots. And by Jaws score, Roland is the has the 10th highest Jaws score of any third baseman ever. All nine guys ahead of him are in the Hall of Fame. Two of the three behind him, Edgar Martinez and Home Run Baker, are also in the Hall of Fame. And granted, Edgar was not a third baseman. He was a DH. Like, you know, he's listed at third base because I don't really know that they're actually not sure why. I mean, he played a lot of innings there early in his career. And then Home Run Baker was a early veterans committee pick that is a little shaky on the numbers, but was one of those guys, I think, more for his influence than for anything he did on the field. And I think it works too, because I think you can see Roland as a kind of easy dividing line between everyone better than him is a Hall of Famer, everyone worse than him is not a Hall of Famer. And I think that tracks when you look at the guys behind him on the Jaws list: Ken Boyer, Buddy Bell, Sal Bando, speaking of RIP, who just passed passed recently, Dick Allen, Darrell Evans, Robin Ventura. Like, these are guys who are very good, but at the same time, never really, I don't think you would look at them and go, oh, why isn't Ken Boyer in the Hall of Fame? Why isn't Buddy Bell in the Hall of Fame? Unless maybe some Tigers fans are really mad that Buddy Bell isn't in the Hall of Fame. But so to me, Roland feels appropriate. I should note there, every guy, I made a mistake, every guy in front of Roland is not in the Hall of Fame. The one guy who isn't is Adrian Beltre, but he will be on the ballot next year, so Adrian Beltre will soon be a Hall of Famer as well.
Yeah, he's going to get it.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be a first ballot choice, no question. I think what the other interesting thing about Roland being a Hall of Famer is it sets up a new kind of standard for the guys currently in the game who have Hall of Fame hopes. And I think particularly in that case, I'm looking at Nolan Arenado and Manny Machado. Evan Longoria actually has a higher Jaws score than both of those guys, but I think it's pretty clear that Longoria is now at the tail end of his career. I don't imagine he has more than a couple seasons left. That number probably is not going to improve appreciably. At the very least, he's still some 7 points behind Roland in terms of Jaws score, so that's all going to be war, and that's going to be tough for him to make up. Arenado and Machado obviously still have a good chunk of their careers left. The other really interesting guy down that list a bit is Jose Ramirez, who I think is going to be kind of similar to Jose Altuve in his Hall of Fame case is going to be predicated a lot on peak and less on career, because each of them had such kind of a slow, middling start to their career before really exploding into being superstars. And obviously we're going to have to see what comes after that. But yeah, I, to get back to your original question, I think Roland is a perfectly sensible Hall of Fame choice. The advanced numbers really love him. Again, one of the best defenders at his position ever. And third base is also a position that is really underrepresented in the Hall of Fame. Again, there are only 8 guys with more career Jaws than Scott Roland in the Hall of Fame right now. And that includes guys like Paul Molitor, who if you ask someone, was Paul, like, what position do you see Paul Molitor as? Well, this is probably an age thing for a lot of us. In my mind, it's, well, Paul Molitor was a DH. Similar with Edgar Martinez. Like, there are not a lot of pure third base guys in the Hall of Fame. You know, that list is basically Mike Schmidt, Eddie Matthews, Wade Boggs, George Brett, Chipper Jones, Brooks Robinson, and Ron Santo. That's really it. Like, this is one of the hardest positions to get enshrined into the Hall of Fame is a third base. And so I think, too, that also probably has an impact on how we look at Roland. Because, again, the top end in terms of career wins above replacement and Jaws at third base is Mike Schmidt. 106.8 WAR, 82.8 Jaws. That is an absurdly high number. When Adrian Beltre gets elected next year, there will be 4 third basemen with 90 or more career wins above replacement in the Hall of Fame. That is an incredibly high standard that the rest of the position has to live up to. And I think it's why whenever we do get, whenever the discussion does turn to Arenado and Machado, however many years from now in the future, they might have a similar problem as Roland, where you think of them at the time, you're like, boy, that was a really great player in his time, you know, a great defender, a great hitter. And then you look at him compared to the historical record, and you're like, huh, he doesn't really come all that close, does he? Because even a guy like Roland, who again feels to me like a pretty solid, a Hall of Famer, is 36 WAR below Mike Schmidt. That's an enormous gap, but that's no fault of Scott Rowland. You know, similarly, I think there are other positions where this is the case too. Right field with Babe Ruth and Ted Williams is another one where the standard is incredibly high because of just how excellent some players of that position have been. But yeah, ultimately, that's
I also
not
just
Scott
hate
Rowland's
the
fault, you know?
Just people get mad at I don't like the discourse for Hall of Fame voting because
The Hall of Fame discourse sucks. It's a large part of why I've kind of started I cared a lot more about this a few years ago, in part because I was also, when I was at SI, I was editing a lot of Jay Jaffe's Jaws work. And so that gave me kind of a broader appreciation for what was going on there, both currently and historically. But yeah, the discourse around who's a Hall of Famer, who isn't, what does that mean? To me, it all kind of fell apart when the Veterans Committee or Era Committee and elected Harold Baines, which is not to put all the sins of the Hall of Fame on Harold Baines, but it's like, if those guys aren't really going to consider the historical kind of like the context, the historical context of the Hall of Fame and how guys stack up to one another and how they measure against each other, then why should we as voters and fans care all that much more either?
Yeah. At also, a point, just like, oh, how does Scott Rolen get in and Andrew Jones doesn't? It's like, who? Andrew Jones is clearly a better all-time player than Scott Rolen. It's like, I mean,
based on what? That's kind of the thing. It's like, yeah. That's based on your personal preference for one over the other. And I think stuff like wins above replacement and Jaws makes it that much easier to rank these guys against each other and measure them. But that really, I think, is better positionally.
Yeah.
Like, comparing Scott Rolen and Andrew Jones isn't fair. They play two completely different positions. The only Can I also say
it'd be weird if Andrew got in and Barry Bonds is never in? Like, that's one of those weird ones, too, which where is, I'm like...
Which is another part of the Hall of Fame discourse that soured me a lot on is, how can you call... Like, how are we having this debate when Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens are not in the Hall of Fame?
Yeah.
I understand why they are not in the Hall of Fame. It's really, like, that debate does not need to be resurfaced ever again. But it still is one of those things where you just go, how can you claim, like... The legitimacy of an enterprise that has decided that it will favor some over others, despite the fact that what we're ostensibly doing here is measuring these guys against a historical context, while also just taking into account the raw output that they produced.
Mm.
But then you're still playing a favoritism game of, oh, well, this guy maybe did steroids one time, so we can't let him into this hallowed... Come on. It's just
this, and it's the whole thing. It's like, you never know. You'll never know for sure who, what, like that whole era. Like, it's just so silly.
To say nothing of, I understand the steroid stuff has an immediate on-field impact, but what do we do? And I'm not trying to equate steroid usage with any actual crime, but when you start looking into, or when you start trying to decide or parse Hall of Fame selection and voting based on, you know, stuff like who they were as a person, who they were off the field, like their morals and their ethics, what do you do about the fact that Andrew Jones has been accused of domestic violence, or Barry Bonds for that matter? What do you do about Carlos Beltran and the sign stealing scandal? That obviously is not as big a deal as PEDs, but some voters clearly felt it was a big deal. I mean, Beltran by the numbers is a Hall of Famer. I don't really know how you can argue that point, but he only got some 45% of the vote this year because I imagine there were a number of people who are like, I don't want to support a guy who basically engineered a cheating ring. That's fair. That's understandable, but how much weight do you give that? What is it exactly that matters most to you in your Hall of Fame vote? What, and without that kind of set standard, like, you know, essentially a line, you say, if you're on this side of the line, you're a Hall of Famer. If you're on that side of the line, you're not a Hall of Famer. It is entirely up to the individual voter. I don't know how you're ever going to get a full body where it feels particularly inclusive of everyone that you like. I think ultimately it just boils down to, what is your personal preference when it comes to the Hall of Fame? You know, what do you want the Hall of Fame to be? And I think, similar to the MVP voting, and I think similar, like, the discourse is similarly crappy for both, it just ends up turning into a kind of person, like a popularity personality contest as to, well, I like this guy more than I like that guy, so I'm going to vote for this guy over that guy, even though the numbers suggest that actually they're the same or the other guy's actually better, whatever. Everyone involved in the Hall of Fame discourse has a bias around it to some degree or another, with the players involved, with the hall itself, with the process, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think without those biases being kind of, you know, brought out into the open, and particularly with the way the Hall of Fame continually puts its thumb on the scales with regards to voting, it's really hard to feel like not that this process is illegitimate, but it takes, I think, a good chunk of the almost fun away from thinking and talking about it. Because it just starts to feel like such an unpleasant, groan-worthy exercise of, okay, well, they clearly don't want steroid guys in, and they're also willing to weaken the overall body by putting in guys like Harold Baines, just because, you know, the guys on the Veterans Committee were teammates with Harold Baines, or he liked him a lot, and they feel like, well, I think you see something like when this was Jeff Kent's final year on the ballot. He got some 45% of the vote. He'll next be up for an ERA committee's vote in, I think, 3 or 4 years. And, you know, he told reporters yesterday he doesn't understand the writers' vote. And I get that on the one part, because I know that there's that feeling from players of, how can writers who don't play feel themselves qualified to judge guys who do play? But then who is supposed to be deciding who goes into the Hall of Fame? Is it the hall? Is it the writers? Is it the players? Is it the how do you decide who makes up the Hall of Fame? And when you start getting into that question, it makes sense that the discourse around it is so miserable. Because everyone has their own interpretation of what the Hall of Fame is, who should be in it, what it all means, what the significance of it is, the value. It just becomes too
much. Let's just let Jay Jaffe only decide. Can we do that? How about Jay Jaffe is just the ultimate arbiter, and he's just, let's just give it to one guy. Jay Jaffe can just be ultimate if you're in
or
not.
But that's that, I think, too, is there's, and I preface by saying I love Jay. He's a, you know, a favorite of mine. I love Jaws. I love the work he's done in the Hall of Fame. He's one of the smartest people out there when it comes to thinking about the Hall of Fame. But I also don't want the Hall of Fame just to be how much war did you accumulate? More than 60? Great, you're a Hall of Famer. Less than 55? Sorry, better luck next time. Like, that's boring. That's really, really boring. Like, to a certain degree, like, I don't really care that Andrew Jones had a terrible second half of his career, or that by the war numbers, he's not. He was an awesome player, one of the best defensive center fielders the game has ever seen in its entire existence.
Yeah.
I don't know if he ultimately, if the entire body of his work is worth the Hall of is worth being in the Hall of Fame, but there has to be something. There has to be something to what he did in his prime, that where he was, for all intents and purposes, a future Hall of Famer. You know, I don't know. I have a lot of jumbled thoughts about this that I clearly haven't entirely worked through, but I think for me, there's just an element of, essentially, the Hall of Fame is whatever each individual voter wants it to be. And because of that, there is no way to get any kind of consistency on what the Hall of Fame is, or who belongs in the Hall of Fame, or any of that stuff, because you can see it in the individual ballots. I think this year was really illustrative in that regard, because there wasn't, for example, the one first-time guy like a Derek Jeter or a Mariano Rivera that everyone can unilaterally agree, yes, Hall of Famer, one of the best players ever. We're not, there's no debate about this. You know, a lot of these guys on this ballot are borderline Hall of Famers in one way or another, it feels like.
Yep.
And so you get a lot of really varied ballots. And also, I think it was interesting, as Jay pointed out in his recap of the Hall of Fame voting for us last night, on Tuesday night, there weren't that many. There was a low number of ballots submitted this year. I don't think we cracked 400. That's a downturn from recent years. I think a lot of people, in looking at that ballot, kind of went, Hall of Fame, the player who's the most Hall of Fame player here is Scott Rolen? And I think there is then that mental, like, dissonance, that cognitive dissonance of, if Scott Rolen is a Hall of Famer, then how can I say Todd Helton isn't a Hall of Famer? Like, they put up similar numbers, you know, or whatever it happens to be. Like, again, you look at the individual ballots, and you can just see that particular strain of, well, this guy thinks Francisco Rodriguez is a Hall of Famer. This guy thinks, you know, Omar Vizquel is a Hall of Famer. But this guy doesn't. This guy thinks K-Rod is, but Vizquel isn't. This guy thinks Vizquel is, but K-Rod isn't. This guy thinks they both are. Like, that is up to each individual as to how they want to make that decision, but it does make it ultimately so that the debate and discourse around this just kind of becomes impossible to parse, because it is all so based on a person's personal preferences.
Yeah.
Like, the Hall of Fame voting is just personal preference at a certain point in time. We can't really argue that it is an impassive, objective look at the numbers and just saying, well, this guy is clearly a Hall of Famer and this guy clearly isn't. That is the case sometimes, like with Jeter and Rivera. But with a guy like Rolen, or more so with a guy like Helton or Andrew Jones or Billy Wagner, where they, you know, you can very easily kind of see both sides of the argument of Hall of Famer in this way, not a Hall of Famer in that way. Then it just falls on the individual voter to be like, well, what do you think? Which do you care more about? Do you care more about Andrew Jones's peak as one of the best defensive center fielders ever? Or do you care more about the fact that his career basically ended at 33? Which of those matters more to you?
The
overall body of work, the peak, you know, without the Hall of Fame being able to say explicitly, this is what you need to focus on. And the Hall of Fame shouldn't do that. That's why I find their stance on PED so irritating, that they have come down so heavily to say, we don't want PED users in the Hall of Fame. You're just going to keep getting this, where you're just going to keep getting ballots where it just kind of feels like, okay. And you're going to keep getting elections, aside from the obvious guys when they float up onto the ballot every now and again, like Adrian Beltre, or I believe Ichiro in about a year or two, where you're just going to, it is just going to be a guy where ultimately you're like, is he a Hall of Famer? And you can point to a lot of numbers and arguments and say, yes, he is. And other people will be able to point to arguments and numbers and say, no, he isn't. Even on a guy like Rolen, where I feel like it's pretty clear that he's Hall of Fame worthy. But there are still people out there going to be like, Scott Rolen's a Hall of Famer? I never bought a ticket to go see Scott Rolen play. Again, that's the personal preference stuff. Like, what is the basis for
weird,
determining a Hall of Famer?
Can you imagine meeting a dude who's like, dude, I need to see Scott Rolen today, so I'll see y'all later.
Look, man, if I had been old enough, like, if Scott Rolen's team had been in town, how cool would that, like, be able to go watch him play defense for the entire.
But he might not get hit his way. He literally might. It might go a whole game.
I mean, that's a that's
Andrew Jones. You're going to see. You're like Andrew Jones might climb the outfield wall tonight. So,
like, truthfully, the only players in baseball you're buying a ticket to go see are starting pitchers and then dudes like Aaron Judge or Mike Trout, where every time they come to a bat, you're thinking something crazy might happen.
Yeah,
you know, a really good defender like Scott Rolen or I guess like Vizquel in his prime was not something where you're going to be like, oh, I want to watch a ticket to watch Omar Vizquel take maybe six ground balls over the course of 3.5 hours. Like, no, that wasn't going to happen. But
doesn't Ben Lindbergh have like a alarm during the season? Like he watches, like he doesn't watch Angels games, but I think he like keeps up with like when Trout and Ohtani's batting.
I'm almost certain there definitely was a Trout bot Twitter account that basically was like, is Mike Trout at bat?
Yes.
And I'm sure there's probably an Ohtani one too, but
that's all we need really for the Angels every year. Don't watch a game. Just keep up with that account. And then
that's
just
the only
watch
way
that.
I've watched Angels games for the last like 3 years is just, is Shohei Ohtani pitching? Is Mike Trout up to bat? Great. Are they, is neither of them currently involved? What makes you think I want to watch Luis Rengifo hit? Like what makes you think I want to watch
pitching straight.
Like, Dylan Bundy pitch? Like, or whoever's on the Angels roster. But like for me, ultimately the Hall of Fame, if it really is just down to the personal preferences of whatever the voting body happens to be it the writers, be it the era committee, be it whoever else, I don't really see how you can even get that worked up ultimately about who gets in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Because it's just up to a select small group of people whose determining factors for Hall of Fame worthiness aren't going to be the same as yours.
Mm.
They're just not. And so kind of arguing about it just starts to feel especially pointless at a certain rate.
What's not gonna be the case here, John Taylor, is the Yankees are going with Aaron Hicks as a starting everyday left fielder to begin 2023. Do you think this is a wise decision, John?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I don't know if I'd call it wise. I'd call it the only internal or the Yankees' highest paid internal option and therefore the one they are going to go to by default.
Mm.
I would be kind of surprised if Hicks were the Yankees' regular left fielder throughout the season.
Yeah.
I think it's way more likely that he's either replaced via trade or that Oswaldo Cabrera ends up taking the great majority of his playing time in left field, probably because Hicks isn't going to stay healthy for the throughout the course of the season. That seems very unlikely too. He's been a very injury prone player the last few years. So, but I mean, this is standard operating procedure for Brian Cashman though. Whenever this kind of thing happens, I'll always think about the offseason when Johnny Damon was a free agent, before the Yankees signed him, when Cashman was saying publicly, oh, Bubba Crosby will be the opening day starting center fielder.
Mm.
And everyone around knew that's nonsense. That's just not.
Man, I forgot about that. That's a way back when.
It is. And then Cashman, you know, went back on his word, something he made like a promise, but like, and then it turned out that Bubba Crosby was not going to be the opening day center fielder because the Yankees signed Johnny Damon. So, I mean, obviously, this isn't the same scenario here because there is no one available in free. Like, the free agency is essentially over by this point.
Yeah.
There's no one left for the Yankees to sign who really makes any sense as a starting left fielder over Hicks. Like, you might as well just go with what you have and see what he can do. But I think it's illustrative of a point that just because Brian Cashman says something does not mean it's necessarily going to be how things play out. I think Hicks will probably be the opening day left fielder, assuming that Giancarlo Stanton is the DH and isn't out there in left field. I don't think that's going to last, though. And I think the Yankees, especially because this Yankees team doesn't have a lot of holes. They have a few select ones, and left field is one of them. And I think that makes it easier for them to focus their resources and attention on fixing that, as opposed to being like, look, man, our roster's a mess. Like, Aaron Hicks in left field is the last thing we need to be worrying about. It's like, we have other problems that are far more important.
The Yankees they feel like really a Byron Reynolds suitor.
And that's the thing. I imagine too that for any team, any contending team looking for an outfielder, be it the Braves, be it the Yankees, be it, you know, the Dodgers, they're probably waiting on the Pirates to come down on the Brian Reynolds asking.
I think Reynolds is already a Brave if the Braves feel better about eating Ozuna's contract. Like, I think that's the only reason that this man is not an Atlanta Brave right now is because they just do not want to eat that contract yet.
Two teams are very reluctant to eat contracts. The Yankees almost certainly don't want to eat Hicks's contract. The Braves don't want to eat Ozuna's contract. You know, we saw how badly the Dodgers wanted to get out of having to eat Trevor Bauer's contract, even though Bauer is a sociopath who shouldn't be in the game any longer. Like, it's really hard for teams to just say, for as much as a guy like Hicks can be a sunk cost, I think it's one thing to say he's a sunk cost, and another thing to say he's just we don't need him anymore. Especially because I imagine the feeling around the Yankees is, well, look, if he's healthy, he can contribute. You know, he's not a bad – it's not like we're talking about 45-year-old, like, Brett Gardner or something, however old Brett Gardner is. This is a guy who within the last couple of years was productive and can be productive when healthy. I just think that Brian Cashman is saying that because, quite frankly, there are literally no other options for the Yankees at this given moment. And I don't think he wants to say we're going to bench the veteran we still owe a lot of money to and start this rookie infielder kid in left field. And that makes sense to me. Let Cabrera win the job, essentially. Mm. Let Hicks lose the job first. Especially because if you're the Yankees, I don't think Aaron Hicks is going to be able to hurt you enough if he is bad that it's really going to cost you at the end of the day. You know, I think the Yankees can survive whatever happens in left field until they find a better solution, because the rest of the team is so strong anyway that they can make up for that deficit in other places.
Yeah, we'll see. It's just what you say right now, and it's just like the Braves have said, Vaughn Grissom's the guy at short right now, and we'll see.
The Braves also have a hole in left field where they're going to try to roll out Eddie Rosario and Marcelo Ozuna.
Playing left field. I will go ahead and stump that one. That man does not find his way into left field. He is a permanent DH until he is DFA'd. I don't think it will be.
Then that creates the other issue of, okay, so does that mean that Travis d'Arnaud is only playing 3 or 4 times a week?
Yes.
Kind of the thing is, like, you end up in this position where it's like sometimes you just have to get rid of these guys.
Well, that one might be okay because Travis d'Arnaud is injury prone, and it's like if you can actually limit his at bats and limit his opportunities in the field. I don't know. I'm okay a little bit more of keeping him out for.
I will say I have more faith in in Hicks being more useful to the Yankees than I do in Ozuna to the Braves.
Oh, yeah,
and I think
for sure.
If I were in charge of the Braves, I understand, Ozuna's owed however much he's still owed over the next however many years.
Mm.
It's really clear he's just not. That is a sunk cost. You know what I mean?
Like,
you just at some point, you just have to move on because rostering him becomes more difficult than figuring out a replacement.
Yeah.
Because, again,
I don't think he's on the roster in August. I think he's DFA'd at some point in the summer. But they are just going to be stubborn about it and really let him rack up the strikeouts and just the negative war and everything else.
I think to a certain degree that's fine, too, because Atlanta is a team like New York where they're so strong over the rest of the roster that they can survive Ozuna kind of flailing his way through a few months to see if there is anything left there. And I think that's ultimately going to be the course the Yankees take. We'll give Aaron Hicks a couple months, see if there's still anything left, see if he can stay healthy. Because if he can do the job, great. Then they don't have to go out and expend.
Makes our lives easier. We want this to happen. It makes it easier.
Exactly. But if it doesn't work, then, they'll have to figure something else out. And I think ultimately the solution is going to be, let's just play Oswaldo Cabrera out there as regularly as we can. If a Brian Reynolds trade or something similar doesn't happen.
Yeah. The best odds from a team that finished last in their division last year to go first in their division this year is who? Who do you think it is?
No one. I genuinely.
You got to pick one, John. You got to go one.
It's not the. I guess it's the Red Sox by default because. Well, look at the rest of the league. It's in the Central. It's the Tigers, and they are not going to be a first place team.
No.
In the West, it's. Was it the Angels or was it?
No, it's the A's.
It's the A's. That is 100% not going to be a first place team. In the East, it's the Nationals. Not going to be a first place team.
No.
In the Central, it's the Pirates.
Also, it was the Royals who finished one game worse than the Tigers.
So, either Detroit or Kansas City, neither of those two teams will be sniffing first place, except for maybe in the first week of the season when they go 3-2 or something.
Yeah.
NL Central with the Pirates or the Reds, whoever it happens to be.
It's the Reds. No. Yeah, they're tied. The Reds and Pirates are actually tied.
Okay, and then in the NL West, I there are better odds that the moon arms hug the earth than the Rockies winning the NL West in 2023. Mm-hmm. I would put not only every dollar I have to my name, but also every dollar to every American. Rockies will not win the NL West in 2023. It's the Red Sox, but it's purely by default because they are the only one of those last place teams that. Where you look at them, you weren't supposed to be in last place.
Yeah.
Every one of those other teams, you're like, you belong in last place. That's where you should be because you're bad. You're a bad team. Like,
if the Rangers were 8 games worse because they won 68 games last year, I'd probably pick the Rangers in a runaway there, but still not feel good about it.
But that's the thing. Like, the Rangers were also trying to be better. Like, I think the commonality among those teams I listed is that none of them are trying to be good right now. The only team in that group. That I think you could say is actively trying to do better to it even that or was trying to do better was Detroit. And that feels to me less like Well, I mean, Detroit was trying, but
I would say the Rockies
running.
Are doing what I don't even know what to call what the Rockies do every year. Like, they signed Chris Bryant, so I'm like, I don't know if they're not trying.
They seem to exist in a weird pocket universe where other teams don't exist and where they just kind of do whatever they want. But that's the thing. Like, even the teams that you look at and you go, well, you're not the A's, you're not the Nationals, you're not just or the Reds, you're not just punting on the season. You're just incompetent.
Yeah.
Like, the Tigers under Al Avila were incompetent. The Rockies under the Monforts are incompetent. Like, the Royals, for the most part, have been incompetent. Like, you know, they're not necessarily cheap, although they don't spend a whole lot, but they're just also not good at what they do. And so for me, it's that until and unless you see them do differently and better. And I guess if you were to say of those teams I listed, I think I would have some reasonable faith in Detroit being better at some point because there is a new face in that.
Scott Harris seems like a good hire.
Yes, he seems like a good hire. And I think that there is the potential for Detroit to be better. But I think the problem there is that a lot of what they were banking on taking them to being better, namely the young pitchers and Spencer Torkelson and Riley Green, that's gone really poorly so far. And they compounded it by making two of the worst free agent signings last year in Javier Baez and Eddie Rodriguez. So it's tough. So I think by default, and again, especially because a lot of those teams, last place teams, also didn't try this offseason, I think it's Boston. But I'm not going to go out on a limb and say that either. Like, that's if any of those teams do it, it is more likely than not to be Boston. But I don't think it's going to happen either.
No, but look, it is interesting that kind of stuff just is not a part of Major League Baseball anymore. We'll end on this.
No, it doesn't really happen. Bad teams stay bad teams until they decide to be good teams, essentially. Be it because they're incompetently run or because they're cheaply run, or both.
Most of the time it's both.
Most of the time it's both.
John Taylor, there was one trade, a pretty big one. We've been waiting for it. Pablo Lopez was traded to the Twins. My question to you, when we look back at this trade 5 years from now, who do you think won the trade?
I mean, I feel comfortable saying the Twins won the trade looking at it from right now. I think, I mean, it's interesting because you don't get a good, like, this is a good challenge trade. You don't really get those anymore.
Yeah.
You know, pitcher for a hitter, like two names you're like, ooh, I kind of like this for both sides. I just like it more for Minnesota.
This trade slaps.
It goes hard, fam. whatever the kids say.
We're so old.
Yeah. It hits me so much every day.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I like it more for Minnesota in part because Arias he feels like a kind of squarish peg in a round hole. I mean, the Marlins had to move Jazz Chisholm to center to make that work. And I also think that for as useful as a guy like Arias can be, that team needs more. And I think I would have liked to have seen them get more for a guy like Lopez, because this is secretly the thing with Miami. For as much as we've talked about, oh, they're great young pitching and how good they are developing pitching, they don't have a lot of depth beyond the guys in that starting rotation right now. Like, and the big thing here is losing both Max Meyer and Sixto Sanchez to injury. Meyer obviously is going to be out the entire year because of Tommy John. Sixto, I don't think anyone genuinely really knows beyond the people on the Marlins what's happened with him and his shoulder. But those two losses alone have wiped out a ton of projected depth for Miami. Like, Yuri Perez is maybe the best pitching prospect in baseball behind Grayson Rodriguez. But at the same time, he's still a prospect. You cannot count on him popping up and immediately being ready to go. Like, to say nothing about the fact that I think playing Arias at second base means I like that the Miami roster is basically oops all second basemen, but none of them are actually good at second. Like, Luis Arias is not a good second baseman. If he were, the Twins would have just been playing him there, but they're not. They didn't.
They're good with Polanco.
They're happy with Jorge Polanco. And I think ultimately that's what makes me think about this, or like this more for the Twins and the Marlins. Pablo Lopez is a better fit for what the Twins are doing because they really, really needed another starter. And not just another starter, but an above-average starter. And they got that in Pablo Lopez, no questions asked there. I think he's a better fit for the Twins than Reyes is for the Marlins. And I think especially, too, Miami having to give up two prospects, too. And not big-name prospects either, but, you know, lottery tickets for the most part. I think that also swings a trade for Minnesota because they get two more additional pieces to work with, be it guys who – they can develop within their system, or maybe they turn around in 6 months and flip those guys as part of a bigger deal for somebody else. So I
wish
really
the Twins had one more arm. Like, they just, it's now just the Pablo Lopez show. Like, I don't trust anybody else in this rotation outside of Pablo.
I like Sonny Gray for the most part. I like Joe Ryan for the most part.
He's all right. It's just a bunch of 4.11 FIP guys. It's just a bunch of 4.1s.
It's tough. But like, I think especially when I mentioned the thing with Miami's defense is that's going to be a really bad defensive infield. And it's an open question as to how good, one, how good Jazz Chisholm was going to be defensively as a center fielder, position he's never played before. Two, how good he's going to be when he has to deal with Avisail Garcia on one side of him and Jorge Soler on the other. Those two are butchers. That's going to be a really tough assignment off the bat for Jazz Chisholm to say nothing about the fact that he missed a lot of time last year with lower back problems, which can have a tendency to be kind of chronic. So, yeah, I think for Miami,
the left side of this infield is Juan Segura and Gene Segura and Joey Wendell. Like, what is this?
Whom should be at that position? That's the other thing. The Marlins are just playing everyone out of – it's like the Red Sox. They're playing everyone out of position, in part because the simpler thing to do would have just been, why don't we just give a lot of money to Dansby Swanson? And just kind of figure it out from there.
John, are they running back Jorge Soler as their permanent DH? Like, is that happening?
Either a permanent DH or sometime left fielder.
Oh my God.
Yeah, this team, this lineup is bad. And that's the other part of this is Luis Arraez is a good hitter, but he does not meaningfully change Miami's offense.
No.
Because that team is way more than one bat away. They're like three or four bats away. And I think
do you think they could have gotten better for Pablo Lopez, or do you think this is the best dot they could have done?
I mean, who knows, really? I think that Miami made the mistake here of getting fixated on a particular type of guy, which is to say a high batting average, high contact infielder, which Arraez very much is, and he's very, very good at what he does. But he's also, again, not really a difference maker for the rest of that roster and lineup. And he doesn't really offer that much flexibility in terms of what you can do with him. He is out of position at second base, realistically. Like, this isn't the equivalent of trading for, like, well, no, it's like Luis Arraez is all players are flawed, but like he is flawed in a way that doesn't really make sense for the Marlins. And I think I would have understood this trade better for Miami if they were coming off like an 85 win season. They are one bat short. They have just way too much pitching. You know, they didn't find a deal in their liking to free agency. This feels more like we didn't try in free agency because we didn't want to spend money. And we were really hyper-focused that we wanted this kind of hitter. Made it happen regardless of what the fit was going to be. We just figure it out after the fact. I don't know. I don't ultimately just don't like it that much for Miami. I think Arraez is a great player, but I just don't really see how much extra he can do for that team given how many holes. Like you said, Jorge Soler is the regular DH on that team. Obviously, Garcia is the regular right fielder. Like there is going to be a lot of Joey Wendell in the monitors. Like, none of that is ideal, really. None of that is ideal. I think this is Miami just kind of not. They're trying to. I think this is Kim Ng trying to make the best of a bad situation, which is basically my ownership group will not let me spend money. Which I think fittingly, too, that we're getting rumors now that there are people interested in buying the Marlins, such that Bruce Sherman had to come out and say, I'm not selling the Marlins, which, no. If someone makes him a big enough offer, he should 100% take that money and run because he. As I've said many times on this podcast, Bruce Sherman does not have the money to run a Major League Baseball team. That's really, really clear at this point. Like, that team is woefully underfunded. And I really would love to see for the umpteenth time in franchise history, I think new ownership could be a good thing here. Because this is the kind of trade you make when ownership ties one hand behind your back and says, okay, so we're not signing any free agents, so figure it out. It stinks. I really like it for Minnesota, and I really like what Minnesota's just done since bringing Carlos Correa back. I think they've kind of not just accepted, but also like made it clear, hey, we're going for this division. We are going to we want to win this division. Like, and it's not going to be a Chicago style. Oh well, you know, we'll make our little moves, and if everything works out, we'll win the division. It's like, no, we're going to actively make moves that will make us the favorite in the division. And I think I really like what Minnesota's doing there and taking advantage of. The fact that they are the favorite now, right? I would say so. I think with Correa back and with Lopez in the rotation, and I really, really like the Michael Taylor trade for them too.
Yeah.
I think that they should be the favorites over Cleveland. If anything, it's just more, and I know Chicago's already had a bad enough week with the Mike Clevenger stuff, but yeah, this White Sox season is going to be an unpleasant one, I think, for a lot of people. They for whatever reason, let that window I think they had to be the best team in the Central just kind of close without really trying to keep it open very long. And I think they're going to see this year that is going to end up leading to not the result that they want.
Yeah. John Taylor, what can the good folks check out from you and the team over at Fangraphs.com this week?
So the Hall of Fame vote is done, but that doesn't mean Jay is done with the Hall of Fame. He's never done. On Thursday, he will have a piece out going, breaking down the Hall of Fame ballot candidate by candidate, voting totals, and to see, you know, what we can expect going forward, where this guy, like what the historical context is for this vote total for that kind of player. And then after that, he will have a 5-year projection looking forward at the next 5 Hall of Fame ballots to see who we can expect in terms of notable first-year names, in terms of when guys are going to be, which guys are reaching the end of their time on the ballot. One notable one for next year, I know Gary Sheffield, next year will be his final year on the ballot. That's going to be really interesting to see if there's a late surge for him to get him over the top. I think it probably won't be enough in the end, but you know, that'll Jay will be looking at that among many other things. For those of you who love the Hall of Fame and love Hall of Fame prognostication, who doesn't miss the bat wiggle? This is a very of my age thing, but no hitter I feared more in any capacity than Gary Sheffield. I remember when he was on the Braves and there was an interleague game against the Red Sox, and it was Pedro. It might have been peak Pedro or might not have been, but it was really, really close. He had an at-bat against Sheffield where I spent the whole time just – it was just a meaningless interleague regular season game, but I spent the whole time like clenching my hands being like, this dude can hit anything. He has the fastest wrist in the entire game. His bat speed is stupid. Like, again, all part of like the Hall of Fame should be as much of that as it can be. Everyone you look at in the Hall of Fame should make you go, yeah, that dude was awesome. At least once, or at least for guys you remember watching play. I mean, I'm not going to go to Candy Cummings as Black and be like, yeah, that guy ruled. Anyway, so Jay will have more Hall of Fame stuff. Obviously, we'll be catching up on all the minor stuff that's coming out there, and we'll be getting ready too for all the big February stuff we have, including our full Zips projections standings-wise for 2023. Zips actually is – Dan is done with his Zips team-by-team projections. San Francisco, which came out on Wednesday, was the very last one. I don't know if you saw the Atlanta one, but it was very, very positive. That team is stupidly stacked. But now at this point going forward, Dan is going to turn to
America loves it.
Projected standings. We're getting closer and closer. Now 1 month away from our global top 100 prospect list. I know BA and BP have put theirs out recently. Ours is coming in February. We're also going to have the return of our positional player rankings, where we look at every position in the majors and rank them 1 to 30 team by team with all the players involved in the position. That's always a very fun debate. I did the one for center field last year and got yelled at a lot by people in the comments. Always a good time. So keep an eye out for that. And yeah, come on over to Fangraphs. We're going to be announcing some new membership stuff, I think, soon in terms of new perks for members and also starting a new membership drive. We really want to get more people signed up for a membership. So if that's you, if you are a Fangraphs reader but are not a member, what are you waiting for? Come on, sign up. Just $60 a year. You get ad-free browsing. You get a lot of other cool features, and we're going to have some cool perks for you, some new perks for you coming in the future. Fangraphs.com. Baseball, good. Baseball is good.
Baseball is good, John. Pitchers and catchers report pretty soon. Tennessee baseball's back, man. In like two and a half weeks. Yeah, they're coming back. They're warming up.
Yeah, college teams are already going south, aren't they?
Say that again?
College teams are starting to go south, right?
What do you mean?
Like the Northeast and Midwest baseball teams are all starting
to make- like that's in a couple weeks. Like it's not quite January. They don't do the January stuff, but it is soon. And that's why they all play down in February. Like they all make they're all snowbirds. They do come down.
Yeah, I mean I saw it when I was in spring training 2020. No, so I was still at SI 2019, it must have been.
Yeah.
I was there to do a story on Adley Rutschman in Arizona because Oregon State had come down to Arizona.
They're playing in an Arizona tournament.
Like Arizona was nothing but a bunch of Pac-12 teams from the northern parts of that conference who, obviously in Oregon, it's way too cold in February and March to play baseball. But yeah, I kind of like that all the college teams just flock south for their own early spring training.
Yeah, 100%. John Taylor, always a pleasure. Thank you as always, and I will talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
This is Ben Ingram, radio voice of the Atlanta Braves, and I'm here to tell you that you've reached the end of today's episode of the Chase Thomas Podcast. As a friend of the podcast, I'd like to say thank you for listening to today's episode and hope you return for the next one. To show your support for the program, tell a friend or coworker or even a family member about the program. And if you're an Apple Podcast listener, leave the show a rating and a review. It goes a long way. That'll do it for me. But don't forget to listen to myself and the rest of the team at 680 The Fan and the Braves Radio Network this season. Go Braves!
Chase, I think I'm going to hear more about you. I really do. I think you've got a way about you, but you're interviewing, mm-hmm. your pleasantness, you're smart. So I think I'm going to hear big things about you.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.